So it's a pleasure to be here. First of all, I want to say Pittsburgh may seem like a dark, foreboding place, but we're a growing group, and I introduce you all, suggest you all come to visit. We have got a lot of effort going on in cosmology starting the last few years. So what I'm going to be focusing on today is sort of an observer's perspective on what we can do for you for measuring fundamental physics using surveys of large-scale structure. So the first thing I'm going to do is talk about the ongoing surveys that you should be ready for data coming out. Public data from these is already starting to come out, and over the next few years, there'll be much more. I then want to give a little warning that I think there's not been enough effort going into looking into systematics at the level that we need to for interpreting some of these surveys in terms of particularly retrospace distortions is what I'll focus on. I want to encourage you to be creative in thinking about how you can use these massive data sets. There are ideas of how to test non-Gaussianity, test the growth of structure, but we may be able to test fundamental physics in a broader set of ways using these same data sets, basically free byproducts. And I'll give you an example of that. And finally, I want to focus on the future. We're going to be over the next 10 years building up potentially basically cosmic variance limited samples for a lot of the sorts of measurements you'd like to do. And I'll talk about a couple of cases of that, Big Boss, and if there's time, LSST. So I'm going to mostly focus on redshift surveys. The idea should be familiar to you all. Goes back about 30 years. The first surveys measured redshifts for about 2,500 galaxies, mapped them out over the sky. The large surveys haven't gone much further out than we looked 30 years ago. So this is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey main sample. You can see it's about a factor of 3 greater in distance. But there's a million galaxies instead of 2,500 galaxies. And that has made all the difference. It's not that you're looking further with Sloan, but that we have a much denser sampling of the universe and a much larger volume of the universe than these first surveys covered. So the new generation of surveys are generally actually looking out. Rather than bigger samples than Sloan, they are looking further. So here in blue is basically what I showed you before, the Sloan main galaxy sample. In green is extending a little further. There's a subset of the Sloan target. So there are about a million galaxies in this blue map. In green, there are about 80,000 galaxies at greater distance, luminous red galaxies, that were sampled over similar areas of sky, about 8,000 square degrees. So you can do the math. That's about 10 per square degree. So a very sparse sample over the sky, but extending further out. In red is sort of where the next generation surveys are going. The largest of them is the BOSS survey, which is part of Sloan 3. So BOSS is going out, again, about a factor of 3 in distance compared to the Sloan main sample. Comparable number of galaxies, so about 1 million galaxies. Comparable area of sky, about 10,000 square degrees. But again, looking much further out, surveying a much larger volume of the universe. So if you compare to the Sloan LRG sample, it's about 5 times the number density in that sample and about twice the volume. So it's going to be a lot more useful for a lot of the techniques people are thinking about at this conference. Just to show you, this little circle is basically a circle the size of the BAO scale, the baryon acoustic oscillation scale that a lot of these surveys are using as a standard ruler test for cosmology. So what are the current surveys you should be thinking about? The first one is Gamma. Gamma is a survey that was actually not focused on cosmology. That's kind of an exception here. It's focused on galaxy evolution. So the idea is to get a dense sample of galaxies. One of the advantages of Sloan is that the number density is high, so we can study things like how galaxy properties vary with local environment. Gamma is intending to do that, but not going about redshift 0.15 like Sloan does, but instead redshift 0.5. So it's a sample of 250,000 galaxies, a quarter of Sloan, so that's a lot. Over 240 square degrees, so it's 1,000 galaxies per square degree instead of 100 galaxies per square degree like Sloan. So it's going to be a dense sampling of about 240 square degrees of sky. Again, their main goal of the people working on it is galaxy evolution, but for a lot of the techniques people apply, this should actually be an interesting data set for things like redshift space distortions. Next, sort of the 1,000-pound gorilla, I guess, is BOSS, which is getting, again, a Sloan-like number of redshifts going to greater redshifts, so basically 0.2 to 0.7 over a quarter of the sky. So it's a relatively sparse sample, about 100 per square degree. WIGGLES is another baryon acoustic oscillation survey. So it's about 340,000 targets. They're finding that they get secure redshifts for about two-thirds of them. Going to redshift 1, much smaller area of sky, so 1,000 square degrees. Again, trying to find the BAO signature, use it to do cosmology. Actually, a denser sample than BOSS is giving, but a much smaller volume. So the final survey is one that's targeted at cosmology, but going at cosmology in a different way, using redshift space distortions. They're targeting about 100,000 galaxies, but they're using the same strategy as the VBDS survey, which yielded about a 40% secure redshift rate. So I'd expect about 40,000 secure Zs at the end. Looking to somewhat higher redshifts, so about to redshift 1.2, but over a much smaller area. So you can see this is a much denser sampled survey than a lot of these. I'm focused on redshift 1. You should also look ahead. In the next couple of years, there will be a couple more surveys starting up that will be interesting for this sort of work. The first is Fast Sound, which would be using a new infrared spectrograph that's basically being put together at Subaru now, a wide area near-infrared spectrograph, to do baryon oscillations at redshift 1 to 2, basically, is the main target there. So a few hundred thousand galaxies, probably a few hundred square degrees. And the Dark Energy Survey, which will be a photometric survey getting photometric redshifts over about 4,000 square degrees and should sample the universe pretty well to a redshift of about 1. So I'll talk later probably about LSST. And a lot of things you can do with LSST, you can do in a smaller way, you know, to lower redshift, about a quarter of the sky area using DES.
The square degrees seem really small compared to numbers I remember for weak lensing, say DES or LSST, which is like 10 or 30 per square.
These are things with spectroscopic redshifts.
Oh, I see. That's
good. Yeah, so that's the big difference. Yeah, that's the hard part of doing the redshift survey. DES is the exception here and only having photometric data.
So why is the failure rate so high for some of these?
So that's a good question. Some of it we know, some of it we don't. Part of it is signal to noise. Generally, you're working at much lower signal to noise at the high Z surveys than you are with Sloan. Part of it is lack of spectral features. There's some subset of galaxies, particularly blue star-forming galaxies, which we tend to pick up more of at high redshift, that actually have only weak features in their spectra. Some of them don't have strong emission lines, so they're hard to get. Part of the problem is the emission lines you do use to get redshifts move into the night sky background lines. VBDS in particular is working at a low resolution and with lots of fringing. Vipers is using the same setup, and that causes a lot of confusion with those lines. So it's actually very difficult to get a secure redshift in that domain. Even at high resolution, though, D2 is getting something like a 70% successful secure redshift rate instead of 40% using the biggest telescopes on Earth, right? It's a very hard thing to do. And as you think about photo Z calibration for some of these surveys, it's something you should worry about because we're systematically missing certain types of galaxies and certain redshifts. Okay. So the method of constraining fundamental physics I'll focus on most in this talk is redshift space distortions. And Vipers is different from the other samples in that this is how they're planning to constrain cosmology as their main purpose. They don't have a large enough volume, for instance, to do BAO at all, but they'd like to do this. So what's the picture? If you look at large-scale structure in real space, in three dimensions, in moving coordinates, it should look isotropic. There's no preferred direction in the universe. But when we look in redshift space, so when we measure an actual redshift for a galaxy, It's anisotropic for two reasons. The first is that as structure collapses, things that are on the far side of a structure are moving towards us from the collapse. Things on the near side are moving away from us in the collapse. And the net effect is that structure will look squashed and wretched in space. Additionally, if you look at a virialized halo, there are random motions of galaxies within those virialized halos that cause an extension along wretched of space. So things have some velocity along the line of sight. And so if you look, for instance, at the clustering of galaxies, so the excess number of pairs of galaxies as a function of separation on the sky, which I'll call RP, and separation along the line of sight, which I'll call pi, you see a squashing of contours of constant clustering due to this linear infall. Sometimes we call it the Kaiser infall. And you see an extension along the lines of sight due to these virialized halos, especially at small separations where you're looking at multiple galaxies in the same halo. Because of that, they have an extra velocity relative to each other. Sometimes we'll call that the fingers of God. So this is what it looks like in a real measurement. So this is from VVDS. This is based on about 6,000 galaxies, not hundreds of thousands of galaxies like some of the samples are talking about. And basically, the level of squashing here depends on the growth of large-scale structure through a quantity we commonly call F. That's basically the derivative of the log of the growth factor versus the log of the scale factor. And turns out to be pretty closely a power law in terms of omega matter, with the power law exponent we'll typically call gamma. And so the squashing depends on F, which tells you about gamma and omega matter, and also the bias, the large-scale structure bias of whatever sample you're looking at. So we'll put those together and call it beta, which is F over the bias, or you can relate it to F times sigma 8. And the goal of this for looking at modified gravity is this number gamma is pretty generically around 0.55 in general relativity. It changes a little bit with lambda, but in a predictable way. Whereas if you look at modified gravity theories, you can get values as high as 0.68. So the growth of structure looks very different in these different theories. So in this data here, so this is 6,000 galaxies over 6 square degrees, so about 1,000 galaxies per square degree. You can compare that to the samples I showed you before. You get a value of beta, sort of a detection at 3 sigma from this data. Okay? Yeah?
Can you say what fraction of galaxies are in the finger of God, or is there any useful information in the finger of God?
So there's very useful information when you talk about halo models, for instance, because it's going to tell you about the mass of the halos your tracer galaxies are found in. So at some level, every galaxy is in a finger of God. It's just when there are two galaxies near each other that you can see it. But even out here, there's basically a random spread of velocities from this effect along the line of sight. So even at large separations, you're seeing a combination of the Kaiser infall and random velocities along the line of sight. It's just most obvious here, because this is where you have most pairs, because when you have a dense region, if you have a cluster of galaxies, say, the number of pairs goes as the density squared.
Does it actually fit the halo model parameters from this thing?
You've only done it on theory. I'm going to talk about that. I'd really like them to. So this is just sort of a summary of where we stand now in terms of measurements. So the points and error bars are measurements of basically beta, or F times sigma 8. So from 2DF, from Sloan. This is the VVDS result I just showed you from Guzzo et al. This is a two-slack result, and you can ignore the open symbols for now. So Viper's goal is to improve on the VVDS errors by about a factor of 3. So a similar redshift approaching 1, but with about a factor of 3 smaller errors. So comparable to what you get from 2DF or Sloan. So I actually spend most of my time working on the deep redshift survey, deep 2 and now deep 3. I didn't show a point there from deep 2, despite the fact that we have a larger sample at redshift 1 than VVDS does. So why not? I thought I'd talk about that a little to give you an idea of sort of some of the issues we might face. Because from deep 2, you'd actually expect errors about a factor of 3 smaller than VVDS. So errors very similar to what Vipers would give. The problem is, this is going back to 2002. This is a plot from Allison Coyle. We played with simulations. We had the GIF simulations where galaxies were inserted semi-analytically into dark matter halos. And we tried to measure beta in those simulations because we knew the answer. We knew the bias of the galaxies. We knew the cosmology that went in. We tried to see if we could get the answer right. And we tried a range of methods, all within the range of the literature, and we got a range of answers. Basically, you could be off in beta by 0.1, which was comparable to our statistical error. And given the fact that we knew these simulations were imperfect, the assignment of galaxies to halos we knew wouldn't necessarily be right, we weren't confident we could really give a secure statement of what we measured. So this went on the back burner. It was one of the main goals for Deep 2 when we were writing proposals 8, 9 years ago. We've measured psi of RP pi. I'll show you that. But we haven't tried to interpret it in terms of cosmology. It's still useful for looking at galaxy evolution. And I think if there are people interested in modeling it with the HALO model, say, and doing better, I think there's a potential to do much better than the techniques we had in 2002. But nonetheless, Gesundheit. I worry. So Guzzo et al., in their paper, tested with the Millennium Simulation mock catalogs, basically a bigger version of what was done with GIF, inserting galaxies semi-analytically. And they found that they got an answer that was systematically off by 0.03 in beta. But that's one set of mock catalogs. One set of mock catalogs that doesn't reproduce the properties of galaxies entirely. So this is comparisons of Sloan data, which is shown in blue, with two different versions of the Millennium Simulation mock catalogs in green and red, tested at redshift 0, which is where they're tuned to match. We have other tests at redshift 1 that the Millennium mock catalogs completely fail. I won't talk about that. But even at redshift 0, so this is a plot here of clustering strength versus RP, so separation in the plane of the sky. You can see blue is the Sloan result. It's matched by one of these curves, so the clustering strength is okay for the green results. But the velocity dispersion along the line of sight, this result of basically galaxies and virialized halos having random velocities, blue is what you measure. Green and red are what the Millennium mock catalog gives, systematically high. And furthermore, so Guzzo et al. Actually assumed that this must be a constant at all separations. That's not what it looks like in simulations. So I think, first of all, we need to test these techniques, not just with one simulation, with a broader range of simulations, hopefully ones that match galaxy property assignment to dark matter better than we have now. The Millennium simulations are great. We use them for lots of things. But nonetheless, they're the best we have, but they're not perfect. Okay? Or the Millennium mock catalogs. The dark matter simulations are fine. So testing with more simulations is the first thing I think we need to do to really assess not just from one simulation what the systematics might be, but the range of what the possibility of systematic errors is with our methods. Another thing I think we need to look at is how well we can actually constrain this quantity, so the line of sight velocity, which ends up being to some degree degenerate with the measurement of beta, how well you can do when your redshift errors are comparable to this dispersion, which is the case for VVDS and Vipers. They have redshift errors of about 300 kilometers a second. So it's not negligible. Euclid will be in the same limit, FADBAL. I think somewhere there can be a lot of progress is in seeing how well we can actually measure beta from observed samples, not using the linear bias assumption that's gone into basically all the papers doing this, but using a real HALO model for assigning galaxies to halos, taking advantage, again, of the fingers of God that give us an idea of mass scale. So there have been a few papers from Jeremy Tinker and Zhang Zhang and collaborators that have looked at this in simulations and find it works really well. No one's done it with data. And we've got rich data sets that are just waiting for someone to exploit them in that way. Another uncertainty that hasn't really been dealt with as you go to a higher redshift is To lowest order, or actually to quadratic order, quadrupole order, the Kaiser infall is degenerate with the Alcock-Pachinsky effect. If you misestimate your cosmology, you'll basically get a misestimate of the Kaiser infall. Guzzo did a basic test of that, found it looked okay, but didn't really do a detailed test. I think as we try to measure things better, we have to worry about that more. And the final thing is when we're looking at these samples that have a broad redshift range, so something like Vipers is going from 0.5 to 1.2, you're selecting very different samples of galaxies at different redshifts with very different biases. At redshift 0.5, you're dominated primarily by relatively massive red galaxies. At redshift 1.2, the only things that will be bright enough basically to be in these samples are going to be bright blue star-forming galaxies, very different intrinsic bias. And you're generally combining data across these lines. Yeah?
In the previous slide, you gave a number of like 0.03 for the beta.
Mm-hmm.
For the Millennium simulation.
Mm-hmm. Systematic error.
Right. What model was used in obtaining that?
So this was using an exponential model for the velocity dispersion and using a basically a linear bias model for the beta.
Basically beta and sigma 1-2.
Yeah, exactly.
And sigma 1-2 is a constant?
Yeah, you treat sigma 1-2 as a constant. Exactly. Which in simulations and observationally, it's not. So I still think there's hope. this is a field that actually has kind of a dark past. If you look at Hamilton's paper on redshift space distortions, which really lays out all the theory, he has a summary of the state of the field in 1997 when it was written. And everyone was getting values of beta of either 0.5 or 1. Right now, we'd say the value should have been probably around 0.4 in these surveys. But the same survey, if you just look out 20% larger in radius, they could change their value from 0.5 to 1. In the same survey, same data, same people doing the analysis. And basically, they had to decide, well, do they believe 1 or do they believe 0.5? And we're talking about, we really want to be measuring this at the level of, 0.03, 0.02 for some of these upcoming surveys. So the reason I have some hope about all of this is that we can tell if we're doing right. And the way we can tell is if we have samples that have different types of galaxies within them. So these are now plots of psi of RP pi for galaxies subdivided by color. So this is now blue galaxies. This is at redshift basically 0.8 to 1. This is from Allison Coyle with D2 data. This is for red galaxies. And this is for galaxies of intermediate color, so green galaxies. So first of all, you see the shape of the Kaiser infall looks different because it depends on the bias. And these galaxies are less biased than these galaxies. These are in between. But you can also see the fingers of God are a much bigger effect for the red galaxies because they tend to live in clusters. Clusters have large velocity dispersions. So we're in two very different domains, galaxies with different biases or different halo models. But nonetheless, the cosmology should be the same. So this factor F should be the same. Unfortunately, the projector's cutting me off a little. So you can tell if you got your answer right, at least, or if your systematics are dominating, by whether you get the same answer with these sets of galaxies with very different properties. And this is true not just at redshift 1. This is a very similar exercise done recently with Sloan and Galax data. Again, blue galaxies, red galaxies, and intermediate color. These look surprisingly similar to me, actually. In terms of how galaxies are mapping onto halos, the contour shapes look very similar at low redshift and high redshift. So there's an alternate proposal, which is to use these samples of galaxies with different biases, and basically, since they're sampling the same large-scale structure variations, to measure the redshift space distortions of both and use them to cancel out the effects of sample variance or cosmic variance in these measurements. That may be a very useful technique in the future, but I think first we need to show that we can measure this well. And I'm not sure we're there yet. Okay. So after that slightly pessimistic take, I want to talk about more positive things, which is really the richness of these data sets we're going to get from these redshift surveys. And I think it's a richness that we haven't thought of all the ways to tap yet. So I'm going to talk about one example, which is using these surveys to test for fundamental physics beyond gravitational physics. I'm testing for variation in the fine structure constant. Why would we do this? First of all, it's one of the easiest ways to test whether the physical laws are universal over space and time. It's predicted by some theories that have large extra dimensions, some scenarios for explaining the dark energy. So, you know, we're not completely crazy to be looking for it. And there have been claims that such evolution has been detected. So we'd really like to test those claims, possibly with more robust methods. Because the problem is the methods that have claimed detections likely have unknown, in some cases known, systematics. So different groups can apply the same methods, and some of them find variation in alpha, and some of them don't. So that's a little worrisome. But with a lot of these redshift surveys, we can apply a much more robust technique, which is using the oxygen 3 emission line. So oxygen 3, which is twice ionized oxygen if you're not an astronomer, if it's in the 1D2 state, will randomly drop down via one of two lines, just a random choice which line, highly forbidden lines at 49, 59, and 5007 angstroms. Because this transmission is forbidden, you don't have any absorption by other oxygen along the line of sight. And because these are both coming from the same initial state, the line profiles of both lines will have to match exactly, basically. There's just a ratio, basically a 3-to-1 ratio of the strength, but the line profile has to be the same. For absorption line tests, which is what's been used to find a variation in alpha generally, that's not the case. The line profiles can be rather different with the different lines. And this difference is actually a fine structure splitting. So it depends on the fine structure constant. Basically, the difference in wavelength of the two lines over their sum is proportional to alpha squared. So what we can do is try to measure the wavelengths of these two lines, compare to the difference in wavelengths at low redshift, and test for changes in alpha. So I've actually done this with Deep 2 data. So Deep 2 is a survey that got redshifts. It's now about 33,000 redshifts, primarily from 0.7 to 1.2, or 1.4. In three of our four fields, we target just galaxies of those redshifts. In one field, partly as a cross-check, we target low redshift galaxies as well. So it's about 30,000 galaxies over 3 square degrees. So 10,000 galaxies per square degree. Again, a jump over these other surveys we were talking about. Basically, four roughly square degree fields. And we're going to an R magnitude of 24.1, pretty faint for a spectroscopic survey, about 300 times fainter galaxies than Sloan looks at. So you need a bigger telescope. We use the Keck telescopes. We got an award of about 90 Keck nights from the University of California TACS. That's the largest project that's been done at Keck. And we're observing at relatively high resolution, which is an advantage, again, for making sure we get secure redshifts for these galaxies. And if you want to play with this data, it's actually all been released. So if you take a Deep 2 spectrum and you change alpha, it's going to change the separation of these lines. So here I've done basically just that, but I've changed alpha by 5%. And so you go from the red line to the red spectrum to the black spectrum when you do that. So it turns out we can detect a change in alpha that's about 800 times smaller than this. If I made a plot like that, you couldn't tell, right? This you can tell. So we've done the test, tried to measure changes in alpha as redshift increases. It's only a small subset of Deep 2 we can do this with. The problem is, basically past that redshift 0.8, the oxygen 3 lines redshift out of our spectral window. So it's only really this part of the survey, basically, that we can do this test with. Down here, the lines are too blue for our window. So we end up with a subset of objects that have strong oxygen 3 lines that are at the right redshifts. The hard part in all this was just getting our wavelength calibration right. We did that by about a factor 20 better than the observational errors, so that's done. And the result is completely consistent with no change in the fine structure constant. So this is just measuring basically delta alpha over alpha squared, delta alpha squared over alpha squared, histogram of the values, you can see nicely centered at zero. So in the end, we find that within 2 parts in 10 to the minus 5, that's 2 sigma, we're completely consistent with no change in the fine structure constant from redshift 0 to redshift 1. It does. I'll actually talk about that. We're unlikely to go higher resolution for other reasons. But,
so yes. Did you include the change in all other lines or just
the you only need these 2 lines. So that's a difference from the absorption line methods. Just the separation of these 2 lines gives you a test on alpha. We did actually test on we looked at the difference, or I looked at the difference between H beta and oxygen 3 just as a test for systematics. You don't see anything.
So I'm just worried that this is that somehow correlated with your redshift determination?
No. Basically, because the line profiles are the same, and the delta alpha, or the change in wavelength, is the dominant term, and that doesn't matter at all what redshift you assign it to.
Okay.
The change over the mean in particular doesn't matter at all because the redshift just affects the mean as well as the change. The bad news is that this limit is still not as strong as the claim constraints from the literature. So I've highlighted in red the claims of detections. So we've got, you know, roughly 3 or 4 sigma detections from different groups. In black are the non-detections with a variety of methods. Both terrestrially based and based on observations of different distant galaxies, distant quasar absorption line systems. And our errors are about a factor of 10 worse, or even a factor of 20 worse, than the errors in the claim detections. So the problem is we only had 500 galaxies in Deep 2 were able to do this measurement with. And our signal noise per galaxy is small. The more galaxies you get, though, the better the measurement gets.
So why is that? Is that you only have 500 that have the required signal noise?
It's 500 and that are in the right redshift range.
Okay.
That's the other issue.
And I guess they all have to be emission line.
Yes. So oxygen 3, you'll only see an emission. So they have to be relatively strong line emitters to do this test well. So you can change your signal noise cut. I've actually done that. And the answer doesn't change at all there.
I didn't realize before, but detections with different methods of opposite time.
Yes, it's kind of interesting. So the way some people have explained that is that basically there's the time variation is reversed because these are different time scales. These are over time scales about 2 billion years. These are over time scales about 9 billion years.
But to be fair, Steve Lamoureux withdrew his claim of this reference, Lamoureux and Todd Torgerson. Steve Lamoureux has now the result consistent this year.
Oh, that's news to me. That's good news. Good.
And there are big concerns about this Fuji analysis. So
yes.
Claim like positive detection from offload. So.
Okay. Well, that actually makes it a little more one-sided, but that's kind of nice.
Do you know what are the constraints from today, from atomic clock experiments?
So they're working on that now. I haven't heard an update, but at Berkeley they're actually working on that. They had sort of, in their first run at least, they had sort of systematic problems in doing the measurement, so they didn't get good results from that. But the possibility is to certainly beat these error levels if those systematics go away.
Sort of assume the linear alpha dot over alpha constant, then the atomic clocks are already surpassing this, and the measurements at NIST with nil results and so on. But that's of course also you don't know how alpha changes over time, right? And it may be different. I mean, it may not have a universal slope, sort of.
And there's actually an additional advantage of doing this with redshift surveys, which you can test not just variation with time, but variation with space. So with Deep 2, we have 4 different fields, widely separated in the sky, basically a Hubble distance apart. We can take the same redshift range, so basically the same look-back time in all 4 fields, try to measure alpha or delta alpha individually in those 4 fields, and test for variation spatially. So this is pretty much the only limit on spatial variation at constant redshift. We're able to set an upper limit of about a part to 10 to the 4 variation in alpha from point to point over sort of 1,000 to 3,000 megaparsec separations. Yeah.
And maybe you don't have enough galaxies to do this, but it seems like you might want to combine the two parts of this. My guess would be a logical way for alpha to vary would be as a function of, you know, say the local curvature or something like that, and therefore, in effect, you know, you'd look for bias or correlation between, you know, density on kind of bias scales.
That would be interesting.
So I guess with 500 objects, you're sort of probing roughly the same density scale for all these things.
Yeah, the volume is big enough, the average density is pretty comparable in all four of these groups. With the future surveys, you can definitely start to play those games and look for correlation with local matter density, for instance.
Well, but they're all emission line galaxies that you're looking at, right? Mm-hmm. So
Some of them are narrow line AGN, actually.
Okay.
So you have the same effect, and actually oxygen 3 is particularly strong in those objects. So we do pretty well with narrow line AGN as well.
I mean, I don't know what the physical models for varying alpha are, but it seems like you might intuitively think it'd be coupled to the local matter density, you know,
I think all options are open, probably. But I'm an observer.
So. I think the models go, they follow potential. That's my recollection, that alpha over alpha proportional to potential. So they are, of course, correlated with matter density, but as potential is. So Newtonian potential. So I suspect one can look for this correlation.
So where we're heading, where you can go with future surveys, is basically, I calculated the number of objects you'd need to rule out or else confirm the claimed detections of variation at 99% confidence. So in Deep 2, we have about 500 objects, partially because we're basically a blind survey, so we're not targeting strong emission line galaxies generally, particularly these redshifts, and partially because only a small part of our redshift range is useful for this test. But BAO surveys are by and large targeting strongly line-emitting galaxies. This is part of their strategy. They're picking out the brightest line-emitting galaxies to be able to get redshifts for. And they're also going to be targeting specifically, you know, if you talk about wiggles, for instance, that's going from redshift 0.2 to 0.7, right where this test is effective. So a way of looking at this is the number of oxygen-3 photons you collect per galaxy. So the same as Deep 2, 3 times Deep 2, 10 times Deep 2, and the resolution of your spectrograph. So as resolution goes up, you need fewer galaxies to do this test. As I said, 5,000, which is what Deep 2 is doing, is pretty much the limit of what you need to do for just measuring redshifts. So actually, as you talk about future surveys, something like Big Boss will be something like a factor of 4 down from Deep 2 in number of oxygen-3 photons per galaxy. Maybe not quite that much because they're targeting emission-aligned galaxies. But as I'll talk about in a minute, instead of 50,000 galaxies total, it's 50 million galaxies total. So you can make up for that loss many, many, many fold. So a Big Boss sample would yield 50 times smaller errors on delta alpha over alpha than Deep 2 would. It's basically equivalent to doing a million galaxy Deep 2 survey instead of 50,000. So the future of this sort of thing is bright. I'm not really pointing out, you know, these surveys do baryon oscillations in this. It's really, my point is, there's lots of things in these data sets. There's lots of measurements that you might be able to tap to do interesting studies well beyond what we've thought of already.
Big Boss just have its own noisy spectra, which are barely enough to measure redshift, and not much more than that.
For these objects, these are sort of the bright end of the luminosity function. So for these objects, they actually do quite well. And you average out over many objects the noise and the redshift. Or, well, it basically cancels out. So you're just comparing effectively the summed lines profile of all these galaxies, which you do very well. So, Gil took all my time.
No, I gave you all your time.
Okay, well, not advertise everything, but I want to advertise Big Boss at least, because I think there will at least be other talks about LSST, hopefully more about Big Boss, but I don't know. So the idea of Big Boss is to try to push almost as far out as we can go in surveying the universe. We're blocked by the galactic plane, so we can't do everything. So Sloan, the main survey, is shown in orange here. This is basically co-moving volume out to the surface of last scattering. The Boss survey, part of Sloan 3, is covering this green region. Big Boss is covering out to this blue region, much larger volume, basically trying to do the last baryon oscillation survey of that volume. And actually gets tracers through quasar lines of sight, even to higher redshift, tracing out BAO and large scale structure that way. So the goal is about 50 million galaxies from redshift 0.2 to 2, about 1 million quasar sight lines from redshift 1.8 to 3. Again, we can look at large scale structure using those sight lines. The first justification, the principal justification of Big Boss, is to study dark energy. So even just a Northern Hemisphere Big Boss survey yields a dark energy figure of merit comparable to what a JDEM BAO survey would do, or a Euclid BAO survey would be similar. But this is a ground-based survey, much cheaper. This is actually, you know, a $2 billion JDEM, not a $600 million JDEM. So JDEM today would look worse than this. And this is a survey that if you actually field the same instrument in the northern and southern hemisphere, which it turns out the same instrument can be used on existing 4-meter telescopes in both hemispheres, could outdo a JDEM BAO survey, again, at much lower cost. So the first goal is to do a stage 4 dark energy experiment, try to constrain what the dark energy may be better. But being from the ground, there's a lower risk factor. You can actually, you know, fix something that breaks, which would be nice. But a second goal, which is quite relevant to this conference, is to test physics going beyond our standard model of cosmology, going beyond dark energy, probing non-Gaussianity, probing modified gravity through the growth of structure. It will also add to the data sets we get from imaging surveys like DES and LSST, primarily by calibrating photoses. But there's also capabilities for follow-up of supernovae, for galaxy-galaxy lensing. They'll be interesting. And it's using telescopes that are currently underutilized. 10-meter telescopes are where the action's at. 30-meter telescopes is where people want to go. 4-meter telescopes are kind of blasé these days. Big Boss can make good use of them. And the first telescope it would be fielded on is the 4-meter telescope at Kitt Peak Observatory. Basically, it's a fiber-fed spectrograph, so you place the fibers at the Cassegrain focus here and lead them off to a set of optical bench spectrographs, which have been optimized for three different classes of targets: luminous red galaxies like Boss targets, emission line galaxies, which allow us to go to redshift 2, and then quasars, again, that we use just as backlights for the intergalactic medium to measure a large-scale structure. And so to study this, we need blue spectra to look at the intergalactic medium. So we have a blue spectrograph. We need relatively red spectra to pick up emission lines going up to redshift 2. So that leads you to the near IR. And we kind of bracket that with another spectrograph to help get confirming features and to do a little better. That. Big Boss will be able to measure the power spectrum up to large scales, set interesting constraints on neutrino masses, particle physics, curvature, the spectral index from inflation. But it will also do very well at these redshift space distortions. I didn't really talk about it, but redshift space distortions are interesting because they probe the growth factor. And the growth factor gives us a strong test when we combine with other measurements of the BAO of whether GR is correct. And Big Boss really leads us into a totally new domain. So this is, again, beta or F times sigma 8. Here are the existing measurements. And Big Boss gets tight measurements at a wide range of redshifts. So you can really map out this curve as a function of redshift. So much stronger constraints than any other survey that's been done or any other survey that's ongoing. It's really the killer survey for doing this. And because of the multiple samples, this is now F rather than F times sigma 8, so the bias has been measured from clustering, sort of this scenario. We have samples that overlap in redshift, so we can do these systematic tests by measuring F with different methods, different samples at the same redshift. Big Boss will also be interesting for constraining non-Gaussianity. So we can, I'm sure we'll see this more, we can write FNL that basically gives us an expansion of how the potential variations map into large-scale structure. And some scenarios for inflation give very small FNL, which pretty much no one can test with any survey on the drawing boards. But there are a variety of scenarios that give values 10, 100, which Big Boss will easily test. So this is from Ans. This is showing the power spectrum measured with red galaxies and with blue galaxies from Big Boss. And the dashed line is what FNL of 5 would do. Big Boss can constrain to about the level of 1, similarly to LSST, which I won't talk about. And because of having multiple samples, we get multiple cross-checks. So it'll be very exciting. So I'll just come to my conclusions. So be ready for these new surveys. Data's being taken now. It's going to come out soon. Most of these surveys will make their data public. Be careful. We have to think more about systematics for doing some of these modified gravity tests. We're reaching the point where the data will not be dominated by random errors as it is now, but dominated by systematics. Be creative. There's lots of new ideas we haven't thought of, I'm sure, of how to tap these rich, rich data sets to study not just galaxy evolution and BAO, but other tests of cosmology. And finally, be optimistic. LSST and Big Boss will bring us very close to being sample variance or cosmic variance limited for a lot of tests you could think about up to redshift 2.5. And these samples over the next 15 years will be reaching completion. So it should be an exciting time. I won't talk about, but if you're interested in galaxy evolution, please, over coffee or something, ask me about Deep 3 or Aegis or the newest thing, which is CANDLES, a large HST program, 900 orbits we recently got time for. So thank you.
The measurements of beta, either from observations or from the Millennium simulation, were they done in real space with the correlation function or in Fourier space with
power spectrum? So in generally, they've been done with the correlation function observationally. Okay. Well, that depends. So for instance, the 2DF measurements relied on power spectrum.
Because the formulation of beta and the Kaiser formula, it's done in Fourier space. And it's what you, the parameters you measure in real space are not entirely equivalent because while beta scale is depends on scale, and the Kaiser formula also doesn't hold at all scale, so once you Fourier transform, it breaks down.
Well, and I didn't even point out that really, for instance, in D2, we were only measuring at the largest scales in D2, where this starts to be an okay approximation. And Guzzo, similarly, is all large, it's dominated by nonlinear scales. So that could well be some of the source of the systematics analysis done. Because most of the measurements are in redshift space.
I think Skoshimar probably would say more. But if you take trivial Kaiser formulas, you transform it, and you test in simulations in correlation function and power spectrum. In correlation functions, whatever you infer from beta becomes essentially constant for scales bigger than 20, 30 megaparsecs. And in Fourier space, it's much worse. It keeps on changing. So essentially, it's not clear why, but I find it's very, very.
But it seems this indication you take the Millennium and you find that offset.
Mm-hmm.
right? And that seems to be, I mean, it just seems like you are taking, you're measuring something where you do have an underlying bias that is scale, that depends on scale, and the Kaiser form does break down.
Yeah, surprisingly, it works as well as it does.
And yeah, if you want to do better than 10%, I mean, there are a lot of things.
But I don't understand why it's better in Tudorian Fourier space than in real space. I mean, you have a scale-dependent bias both in Fourier space and in real space. So
no, I mean, I'm saying that the bias, because it varies its functional scale, if you take the power spectrum and integrate it with the correlation function, then the biases are different now. The betas are different.
Sure, but on larger scales, they are the same. On the smaller scales, they are different. That's
true.
Don't
you agree? Not entirely. I think it's the integral. Depends on the integral.
So, what's the latest on LSST?
Okay, so I'll say two things. First is the LSST science book has most of the latest on LSST, so you can find that here. You can find it on AstroPH. About 250 people worked on this thing, a 600-page book. Trying to spell out the science we can do with LSST, again, we only figured out a subset of it. I'm sure there's a lot of things we'll do we haven't. You can see, going from the solar system on out to testing things like modified gravity, we've at least thought a little bit about all these things, and hopefully you all have thought more and can contribute in the future. Just giving you an idea of how rich the data set is. And here's, this didn't quite come out. So here's sort of a timeline where we are now. We've actually already started construction of the primary and secondary mirrors, which are the longest lead time item. It takes years to grind. We're going to start potentially this year blasting at the site to flatten off the mountaintop where it's going. And currently, the timeline puts us at engineering first light at the beginning of 2016. System first light beginning in 2017, and really starting the main survey in 2018, but there's sort of almost a year of test data, which will be interesting, basically operating in quasi-survey mode already. And, you know, we're really waiting for the decadal survey results, but all signs are good. So I think once that happens, all the money starts flowing, and we jump onto this timeline.
All right, on that happy note.